Tonight, on this recorded edition of Extension 720, it is a great pleasure to welcome back to the program Robert H. Bork, distinguished American jurist, theorist of law, and more broadly, observer of American society, a former Solicitor General of the United States, and these days a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and the author just now of a new book titled Coercing Virtue, The Worldwide Rule of Judges. This was done originally as a series of lectures up in Canada, wasn't it?
It was a lecture at the University of Toronto in memory of Barbara Frum, who was a very popular Canadian TV journalist.
But you didn't spare your hosts.
No, I repaid their hospitality with recounting the sins of the Canadian Supreme Court.
And the American Supreme Court.
Oh, well, sure.
And the Israeli Supreme Court. Three interesting Supreme Courts, to be sure. Why those three rather than 10 others?
Well, United States, I thought most readers would be United States, and therefore I should cover that. I had to discuss Canada because I was in Canada, and it was a Canadian lecture series. And Israel I chose because it's the worst Supreme Court in the world, as far as I can tell. It has the most extreme tendencies of everything that goes on here, but magnified many times.
You are judging the Supreme Courts of any country by the degree to which they arrogate power and take it away, essentially, from the legislative and or the executive branch.
To that degree, in cases where they do not have any authority in their actual constitution. But I went on to discuss, I tried to deal with the rest of Europe, or the Western world, by discussing the internationalization of law, international tribunals, and national courts picking up themes from other national courts.
I was astonished to find from your book, to learn from your book, Coercing Virtue, that some of the justices on our own Supreme Court are using law from other nations as precedent in at least justifying some of their opinions.
That's right. Lawrence against Texas, which was the case involving homosexual sodomy, the court cited, Justice Kennedy cited a decision of the European Court, and in the Michigan minority preference case, Grutter against Bollinger, Justices Ginsburg and Breyer cited a European Convention against discrimination. So it's not just court decisions abroad, but various legislative acts and resolutions abroad are being cited by our court.
Not as absolute precedent upon which a legal decision is based, but merely as, I would think, that sidebar or a footnote, is it?
Well, yes, a reinforcement or something of that sort. It really got funny when Justice Breyer, in one case, who was dissenting, said that we should be guided, we should accept guidance or find useful, although not binding, decisions by the Privy Council of Jamaica, Supreme Court of India, and the Supreme Court of Zimbabwe, of all places. The internationalization of law has gone some distance. In fact, it's gotten to the point where Linda Greenhouse, who covers the court for the New York Times, wrote that the justices increasingly view themselves as engaged in an international constitutional conversation, which means we're going to get an international form of constitutional law, which has less and less to do with our actual constitution.
Well, now, is that not in some sense desirable?
I can't think of the sense in which it is, but
over 100 years ago, the great poet Alfred Lord Tennyson, in the poem Locksley Hall, looks forward to the time when the war drum throbs no longer and the battle flag is furled in the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World.
Yes, and if he was talking about the United Nations, it was nothing to brag about. No, I can't. Maybe there will come a time, but that time is a long way off, in which international interests are congruent. Right now, it's a battle of interests and opposing interests in international affairs and in international tribunals. There's a great deal of anti-Americanism.
Lord knows there is, in every possible direction, though I was rather amused yesterday. I'm sure you saw it. I found it on the front page of Le Figaro, but then I see that it's also on the front page of the New York Times, a picture of Jacques Chirac kissing the First Lady's hand, and she's looking at the camera in rather strange amazement.
That's right. She doesn't know what to make of this.
One of the funniest pictures I've ever seen.
Yeah.
So she can somehow seal over the rift between the U.S. and France. I come to what I think is the main thesis of your book, namely that the cultural and political left works its will upon what you call the traditionalist majority, and it works its will more through the courts than through legislative or even executive action.
That's true. In fact, the what we can call them, the intellectual left, or whatever, however you want to, the new class, however you want to categorize them, has a value system that is quite different from that of the ordinary American, or the ordinary Frenchman, or the ordinary German, or anybody. It's true across all nations. And they, if you put their values on a ballot, they lose the election. But if they can go to a court, they can get a court to enforce their values.
Well, I must ask you immediately to enumerate those values. In what way does that that presuming minority value differently than the traditionalist majority?
Well, for example, our Supreme Court gave us the most permissive abortion law in the world. It was, China, they require abortions, but in any country where they have a choice about it, more permissive than any state in the Union, more permissive than the European countries. The normalization of homosexuality is taking place through the courts, not through the legislatures. You get racial preferences are being reinforced by courts. You have feminism is being advanced by courts. And there's more. I'm trying to think of, I had a list of them in the book. But there's a whole series. The strongest difference between intellectual class preferences and the traditional general public is about religion. The intellectual class, or I hate to call them that because they aren't that good at intellectual.
My preferred word is intellectoid.
Oh, that's not bad. Intellectoid, that's good. Yeah. I was just reading Kenneth Minogue. He uses Olympians.
Mm-hmm.
But intellectoid's a good one. But there's a striking difference in every country of the West between the elite, as they view themselves, and the common herd, as they view us, in terms of religion. They are hostile to or indifferent to religion, and the general public is quite favorable towards religion.
Well, putting religion aside for the moment, but when it comes to, say, the endorsement of greater freedom and open admissibility into society for homosexuals, for women, and for other minorities who have legitimate grievances based upon their history, many of my colleagues at the University of Chicago, some of them, to be sure, across the Midway at the law school, would say, well, yes, but look, the real business of law is not just strict constructionist interpretation of the Constitution written so many years ago. It is, rather, to redress injustice. And law grows, law adapts. We have that jurisprudential tradition laid down for us even as early as the writings of Justice Cardozo. Critical legal theory of the sort that has flourished at Harvard and other such law schools certainly clarifies that there is a kind of an obligation upon judges and upon lawyers, upon men and women of the law, to improve and advance social justice.
Well, of course there is, but it's not. There are a variety of ways to advance social justice, whatever that means, by the way. I'm not entirely clear what it means. But usually we do it through legislatures and through elections. When you say that a court should do it, contrary to the will of the majority, then you're saying that the court has a different view of what social justice is from the majority of the people, and there's no clear reason why a court should have its views prevail if there's nothing in the Constitution to support it. Now, as far as women are concerned, I don't think women, I know they're feminists, are still carrying on about how unjust things are. The fact is that women are now moving into, I think that Lionel Tiger, the sociologist, estimates that in 10 years, only a third, I think, of bachelor's degrees will go to men.
We already have a majority of women in the undergraduate population of American colleges and universities.
Yeah. And increasingly in the graduate schools, and increasingly in executive positions in industry. So I don't think the court has to do anything about that. Although they do. One of the ironies was that in the case, the white student who was denied admission to Michigan Law School because there was a preference for minorities, the Supreme Court said, well, the University of Michigan Law School says that they need to increase the number of minorities in order to provide a quality education. And the court said, we defer to that judgment. Now, when the Virginia Military Institute said that in order to run the kind of adversative training, as they called it, at Virginia, they had to really be all male, the court gave no deference whatsoever to that educational judgment, which indicates that the court is sympathetic to minority racial groups and unsympathetic to white males, but sympathetic to women. So it's purely a political syndrome. It has nothing to do with logical consistency within the law.
Maybe that explains the transgender movement. Maybe some sensitive males have caught on to that and have more or less known in their bones, if not with full rational clarity, that the best way to function in this world is to turn from being a male to being a, quote, woman.
Yeah, well, it's a, quote, woman. It's not a woman fully. And that's a hell of a price to pay, I must say.
Yes, well, I would agree. But look, I can't, I'm not in a position to really do legal history with you and to do particularly judicial history and Supreme Court from the beginning. But don't we get this established, that is the claim for judicial review, which in a way arrogates to the court the power of the legislature. Don't we get that established quite early in the history of the American Supreme Court?
We do, about 1803. But
that's the case of Marbury
against Madison
versus Madison.
But that case, John Marshall purported to be reading the actual Constitution and finding the principle he was applying in the Constitution. Now, that's perfectly valid, and as times change, the principles will find different application, but it'll be the same principle. The example everybody gives, of course, is the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. The framers were talking about a constable coming clomping into your house. But when electronic surveillance came in, the court hesitated for a while. Then they realized it was the same principle, government intervening into your private affairs without a cause. And they applied the Fourth Amendment to electronic surveillance. That's fine. That's the way law should grow. But when they begin to make up new principles that aren't even in the Constitution, as they did in the abortion cases, as they did in the homosexual sodomy case, as they did, they have completely subverted the First Amendment, both in the religion clauses and in the free speech clauses. I mean, now pornography is allowed to run free as speech. You can show oral sex on cable, and the Supreme Court protects it. You can show computer-simulated child pornography, and the Supreme Court protects it, and they have in these cases. On the other hand, when it comes to restrictions on political expenditures and so forth, they aren't concerned as much. So that they've turned the First Amendment free speech thing upside down. They're protecting pornography and not protecting sufficiently political speech, which should be the core of the First Amendment.
What about mounting in the lobby of the building that houses the Alabama Supreme Court, some statuary that features the Ten Commandments?
That, under the original Constitution, that would have been allowable. Under what the Supreme Court has done to the Constitution, it is not allowable. And the justice in the Alabama court who did it must have known that he was going to be told that that was not allowable. However, there is an excellent book by Philip Hamburger, who was now, the last I heard of him, he was teaching at the University of Chicago Law School. He's a legal historian, called Separation of Church and State. And he proves beyond doubt that the utter severity with which we separate state and religion, you know, students can't pray if nobody gets hurt before a high school football game, that kind of nonsense, That was not in the history of the religion clauses of the First Amendment.
I've never understood all of this fuss about separation of church and state when on our very money is inscribed, "In God We Trust."
That's right.
The legal tender of the United States.
And although this judge in Alabama can't put up the Ten Commandments, Moses coming down from Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments is painted on the walls or the roof of the Supreme Court courtroom. It was a little odd.
Well, consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds, said Emerson. Maybe that explains it all.
Foolish consistency, he said.
Foolish consistency, yes. To be sure. Our guest is Robert H. Bork. We're drawing from his very significant, though rather brief, new volume, Coercing Virtue, The Worldwide Rule of Judges. And that is published by?
American Enterprise Institute.
Where you are a resident fellow.
Where I am for the moment. I am leaving the Institute.
I didn't know that. Where are you going?
Well, I don't know yet, but I'm gonna write more at home.
Uh-huh.
And if another institutional connection comes up, I may or may not. I am currently a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution.
Oh, out in California.
Yeah, I don't go out there, but I do some work for them.
Sure.
But whether I will make another institutional hookup or not, I don't know. But I can write books as well from home as I can from any place else.
And this fine book, which I gather was written partly at home, deserves still further discussion, and we will proceed with that right after we pause for this. And we return to Robert H. Bork, drawing from his new book, Coercing Virtue, The Worldwide Rule of Judges. One can't resist the obvious ploy in noting that your identity has put a word into the English language. I'm doing a program in a few nights with the two lexicographers, one from Merriam-Webster's, the other from the Oxford Dictionary of the English Language. And in both of them, you have the word to bork as a verb, which refers to the Senate having given you a hard time when you were nominated to the Supreme Court by President Reagan. And essentially, you withdrew, I think, before the vote.
No,
did
I didn't.
You
didn't.
Were voted down.
No, I insisted upon going through the
course.
Vote. I knew it was. I knew that the count was against me, and I couldn't win. But I insisted on going forward.
But I raise this now, for a special reason. Is the power really ultimately in the hands of the judges, or rather, as somebody says about men, all men after 40 get the faces they deserve? Is it possible that we get the courts we deserve? Because the control, ultimately, of Supreme Court nominations in this country is in the hands of the legislative body.
Well, I think you do get the judges you deserve. In fact, sometimes you get better judges than you deserve. I can think of a couple of cases right now that are better than we deserve. But
when we bork the good guys, we are, then the Senate, and more broadly, the legislative body and the journalistic core behind them are saying, in effect, we know the kind of judges we want. We want liberal judges.
Oh, yeah. No, the phrase to bork originally came from not from something like Planned Parenthood or some interest group of that sort. It didn't come from a senator. When Clarence Thomas came up, this woman said, "We're going to bork them."
Yeah.
Now, I don't mind that becoming a verb because I view it as a sort of form of immortality. It's like Captain Boycott or Hobson's Choice, Hobson being a livery stable owner in London. If the verb goes on, of course, in the future they'll think that I did the slander.
But my broader point is doesn't the responsibility really still lie with the elected officials?
Oh, yes. There's no doubt about it. And the Democrats right now have demonstrated that they want activist judges who will apply principles that are not in the Constitution. And the last thing they want to put up with is a judge, I don't like that term strict constructionist, I talk about a reasonable constructionist. The last thing they want to put up with is a judge who sticks to the actual principles of the Constitution, because they know they can get their agenda through a liberal court much better than they get it through Congress.
What has the American Supreme Court done to transform American society over, say, the last 20, 30, or 40 years? Take it where you want by way of beginning.
Well, I think we have a coarser, more vulgar society than we otherwise would have, because the court has struck down repeatedly legislative and administrative attempts to draw a line and say, no, you can't say those things on the air, you can't say these things in public, and you can't display these things in public. The court keeps striking that down. And when they do that, they not only remove the legal barrier to this vulgarity or obscenity, they validate it morally. Because when you tell people it is constitutional, they think it's all, it's not only that, it's virtuous. So that's one thing the court has done. The other thing that they've done is I think they have helped to sideline religion. Christopher Lash said that one reason that we don't, we lack the kind of self-discipline and that are virtues that go with a democratic society is the fact that religion has been sidelined. And I think it has been. Now, the intellectual class would have done that anyway in large measure, but the court has helped them to view religion as a dangerous influence.
Through what sorts of decisions?
Through decisions under what the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. The Establishment Clause says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Well, we know what an establishment of religion was, and they did back then, too. It's the state favoring a particular church. And there were two reasons they didn't want it. One is they didn't want the federal government establishing a religion. But one reason they didn't want it was because some of the states had established religions, and they didn't want the federal government ousting those established religions in favor of their own. But an establishment of religion is the state favoring a particular religion. That's never what's taking place nowadays. Nowadays what's taking place is that any religion that comes in contact with the public through a creche on a post office or a Ten Commandments in a high school wall. Or
the decision by the Ninth Circuit out in California.
Under God.
Disqualifying the Pledge of Allegiance.
Yeah, under one nation under God. They held unconstitutional. The hatred of religion has now assumed ridiculous proportions. I have a friend, when they said, the Supreme Court said that, in one decision, they said that nude dancing deserved a considerable amount of constitutional protection because it's expressive. We need not stop to ask what it expresses, but anyway. But the high school students can't pray before a football game. And my friend, who was an advocate in the Supreme Court many times, said the lesson is that the high school students should dance naked before the game rather than pray. And of course, one trouble with that is they can't get nude by doing the dance of the seven veils because that has biblical connotations.
I want to put something to you that I've just encountered within the last week. I'm horrified by it. You spoke earlier just a few minutes ago about how our society has grown more crude, you said. More coarse, I think was your term. In fact, I've long intended to write a book that may wind up as an op-ed titled The Coarsening of American Society, or The Coarsening of America.
I hope you make it a book.
It should be a book. You've done a book very much like it in Slouching Toward Gomorrah.
That was part of the book, but a whole book could be written on it.
But listen to this. I bet this may be something you haven't heard about yet. There is a commercial firm in England. They do clothing, advanced stuff for young people. And their name is the French Connection UK. Or at least the French Connection was their name, and they are incorporated in the United Kingdom. They're based in London. So their initials are FCUK. They've been in existence for a number of years, but only recently have they started a new line, which has emblazoned on T-shirts and on all other things that they produce, the letters FCUK. They've also started...
You misspelled that a bit.
That's the way they spell it.
Well, you misspelled it. Okay.
Yeah, FCUK. But as you look at that, you do a double take.
Yeah, sure.
And clearly another word instantly pops to mind. It's the one, the vulgar term for sexual intercourse. They also have a new line of fragrances, as they call them. And one is called FCUK Him. Another is called FCUK Her. A major department store in Chicago, I discovered from a brochure they mailed around, is featuring all of this. And in their store, they've got big banners about FCUK. A number of people are responding with shock. that's only the Chicago instance of what apparently is a broad phenomenon. Just this very day, I spoke with the public relations person for that department store chain. I'd made an inquiry a few days ago, and she got back to me today. And she had the typical PR response, well, we are here simply to serve our clients. That's the customers,
what they want.
And that's what they want. And I asked her, have any been offended? Have you had any negative feedback on this? She said, yes, well, we've had both. Some people are amused, and some are rather bothered. And that's where it stands. Now, how does all of this bear on matters of law? Was there a time when, in this country, you couldn't do that sort of thing while pushing a commercial product?
I think so. You couldn't do it under any circumstances. But the real word, spelled correctly, of course, was on a jacket of a young man. You'd know about this case. The young man wore into a courthouse. Mm-hmm. With FUCK, the Selective Service System, the draft on the back.
Uh-huh.
And he was convicted of public disorder or something of that sort. And the Supreme Court reversed his conviction and said, one man's vulgarity is another man's lyric. Well, that's insane. Under those circumstances, one man's robbery is another man's redistribution of the wealth. For social justice, you can't run a society in which all tastes are equal, no matter what it is. But the Supreme Court has been doing that, and not just in that area.
If anyone complained and tried to sue the department store in question, or tried to sue the company, though they're based back in the UK, would there be any possible basis on which they could proceed in court?
I can't think of any. It's funny. Because the one area in which they say that being offended is enough to give you standing to sue is religion. If you see a creche someplace and you say, I'm offended, and you can sue. Nowhere else in the Constitution is that kind of harm to you, not really harm, enough to sue on. And, of course, if you saw something like that that offended you, you couldn't sue.
Now, you focus, of course, on the works and ways of the lawyers and the judges, who are elevated lawyers. I'm a man of the universities, and I've been there all my life. So meanwhile, back on campus, what's been happening, and you well know this, you've written about it also, is that all notion of arbitrary and significant value has been thrown away, at least by those who deal in modern or postmodernist theory, so-called, and who borrow from the deconstructionists or the 100 other varieties of modern intellectual nihilists. And all of them converge on the basic argument, the basic judgment, that it's arbitrary, it's foolish, it's déclassé to say, this is good, that is bad. This is beautiful, that is ugly. This is desirable, that is not. Let a thousand flowers bloom.
Yeah, well, they mean it about as much as Mao meant, let a thousand flowers bloom. Somebody defined postmodernism as an uneasy alliance between nihilism and extreme left-wing politics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it is, I think. And
but on the matter that I've just been raising, this marketing campaign by the British firm, they wouldn't be offended. They'd be amused and titillated, and they'd say, of course, this is totally acceptable and justifiable, wouldn't
they? Sure, they would, but that's because it's anti-bourgeois.
Yeah.
Now, the people who say
because it shocks.
Huh? Yeah. Outrage the bourgeois.
Épater les bourgeois.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if those folks who say there is no truth, there are no standards, they say that, and in saying it, they attack traditional distinctions and hierarchies and authorities. But it turns out that they are very fierce standards of their own they want to impose on the rest of us. So they're not. It's not that they really believe there are no standards or no truths. They think they have it, and they think it's left-wing, and they're going to impose it on the rest of us.
The great question is, how did it get this way? This is part what's happening in the courts, what the courts have been doing, you say, in this very important new book, Coercing Virtue, is part of the larger culture war that has been raging for quite a while in the Western world.
Yeah.
Why did the culture war erupt as it did, and why have the sides shaped up as they have, and what is our future as we are still caught up in the culture war? Who ultimately will win, and how? Let's pursue some of those questions, if we might, after we pause for these words. And we return to conversation with Robert H. Bork. You are, of course, a member of the High Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia. Are you then entitled eternally to be Mr. Justice Bork or Judge Bork?
No. My usual answer when people ask me what I should want to be called, I say anything so long as it's civil.
Well, it's more than civil on my part, because I've had a great admiration for your achievements over the years and for your contributions to social analysis. And I ask you then to turn to what is the ultimate question, which haunts your book, and you address it as well. The judicial things that you're talking about and the great arrogation of power by activist judiciaries, you see as part of the great culture war struggle. What's the nature of the culture war? Who are the sides? What are they after? How did it happen? What will come of it?
Well, that's I will do my best to deal with that. I think it started with the decline of religion. I don't want to sound as if I pin everything on religion, but religion provided people with a meaning in life back when religion was a powerful force in society. And Max Weber said that as religion declined, certain classes of people, and he named them which classes of people, teachers and so forth, would move to the left. Now, I think that's because people who need a transcendent value, who need a meaning in life, and as they lose religion, what's available? Well, what's available is left-wing utopianism. Conservatives don't have any utopian views. Their kind of position is, wait a minute, that's not such a hot idea. But you can't rouse much passion. A typical conservative parade would feature a guy marching at the head of a column with a sign saying, be reasonable. And that doesn't turn them out into the streets. But the left-wing utopianism, socialism, had an enormous appeal to these intellectual classes. But that wasn't too serious until the intellectual class exploded in size. And I think that was post-World War II. The GI Bill may be in part to blame for this, but you got an enormous number of college students for the first time. You got the result in an enormous expansion of the number of professors and colleges. So that those groups, I think for the first time, were large enough to form their own culture. There had always been in intellectuals some dissidents against the conventional culture. But now they had a big group that could form its own culture, and they started off being very liberal. And then when the student revolutionaries hit in the 60s, the faculties, which were already talking a language that sounded like the student revolutionaries, but they didn't carry it as far, proved very soft and rolled over in front of the students. Very few universities stood up to their revolutionaries.
So you are in the camp that one might designate with the great title of Richard Weaver's book, Ideas Have Consequences.
Yeah.
And these ideas, the ideas of socialism, the ideas which elevated social justice above everything else and which pushed religious commitment aside as
oppressive.
As oppressive and also as not worthy for persons of intellect.
Superstition.
Yeah. That is what the Great Transformation was. I tend to agree with you, though there must also be socioeconomic factors that contribute to all of this. But I would raise another question, still dealing with ideas. Marx, then, is the source of many of the ideas which have done us great injury and brought us to near ruin in some ways. What about Freud?
Well, I don't know. I never had any direct experience with Freudianism. I know that when I was going to the University of Chicago, a lot of students were in psychoanalysis.
To be sure. Many of their professors as well.
Yeah. I remember one young woman telling me that she had thought that anybody who said they didn't need psychoanalysis was sick, you know.
But one of the real derivatives of the Freudian Weltanschauung is that finally everything that we think we believe is probably untrue, because it has its roots in our unconscious and in deeper, darker impulses, in the polymorphous perverse rather than in the achievements of reason. And thus the ultimate push is toward a skepticism about any value that is claimed by an organized system of meaning.
Yeah, that's right. The only the sexuality becomes the most important thing, and your what you think are high motives or decent motives turn out to be something that some infantile rage you had
so
before you were even conscious of having.
That's the the way that that line runs, and I think it's also converged with the general socialist line, which predated it by 50 years in its original formulation, if one just thinks of the dates of Marx, and or 70 years, the dates of Marx and Freud. But now we're living so much later. After all, we're now in the 21st century. Why does this kind of aggrieved disillusion with traditional order and a kind of misplaced desire for social justice, as they define social justice, still animate so many of our intellectuals?
Well, I think they still have, although socialism has been discredited as an economic theory because it collapsed. I wouldn't bet that it doesn't come back, but it's been discredited for the time being as.
Oh, but Marxist
theory.
Analysis flourishes in more than any place else in the world in the American universities.
Oh yeah. No, I meant as a viable political movement.
Yeah.
But I think socialism is broader than an economic theory. It's about equality generally, and I think the drive for equality, which leads to relativism and so forth, is very strong in the intellectual classes. And socialism has moved now from economics to lifestyle, and that's what the Supreme Court is dealing with now, is lifestyle issues.
Where do they intrude upon our lifestyle?
Well, in what you see, what you thrust in your face on television and movies.
Ah, oh, yes.
What your children are taught at school, which is likely to be about sex at a time when they're not conceivably prepared to handle that subject, and about all the other things we've discussed about religion, pornography, obscenity, and so forth.
There's also a great leveling tendency in the schools. I find, as a college professor who's been one for a long, long time, that every 5 or at the most 10 years you see another significant drop in the level of preparation of the students who arrive as freshmen or sophomores. And even by the time they're seniors, it hasn't all really been rectified. They just know virtually nothing. They can't use the language effectively. And so there's a failing in the public schools which prepare them or fail to prepare them. And I wonder how much of that is due to a leveling tendency, generally dumbing everything down to accommodate those who are culturally deprived to begin with.
Or culturally or just intellectually deprived. As a matter of fact, when I taught at the Yale Law School, as you know.
You taught Hillary and Bill Clinton.
Well, no, I don't say I taught them. I say they were in the room when I was
teaching.
They
took courses for you, yes.
No, I don't claim them as products of my teaching. They had in the entering class, they have to take one course which involves writing assignments. And in the time I was there, from 62 to 81, every year the writing got worse.
Yeah.
Which indicated that the colleges were accepting worse and worse stuff out of the public schools. But it's really frightening because language and thought, as you well know, go together. And if you can't write clearly and articulate things clearly, you're not thinking clearly either.
Are you in quiet despair, or do you see any possibility of a reversal of the trend with regard to the general dumbing down and vulgarization of our, and more broadly, of Western society?
Well, fortunately, I don't believe in my capacity to predict anything accurately. But I never would have predicted the 60s, for example. They burst upon us. But at the moment, I don't see any trend to reverse the way things are going.
What about the rise of intellectual conservatism?
Well, that's important, but I'm not sure how broad a movement it is. Now, you have magazines like, in the cultural field, you have the New Criterion, a marvelous magazine, but it's got a circulation of 6,000 or 7,000, mm-hmm. probably the best magazine in America, I would think. Then you have Weekly Standard and National Review and so forth. But when you put them all together, you're talking to a very small group of people. And I don't know that Rush Limbaugh is somebody who talks to a wide group, but I think he's preaching largely to the choir. And meanwhile, the universities and the churches and so forth move on.
Well, what about political representation of the kinds of values that you think are honored more in the breach than in the proper observance? What about, if one can name it directly, it's a broad entity, the Republican Party and the current National Republican Administration?
Well, I like the Republican Party better than I do the Democratic Party, because I don't think they are... I think the Democratic Party is headed for really radical solutions, radical measures, and I think they're going to wreck the judiciary, among other things. But I'm not a great admirer of the Republicans. I don't think the Republicans have behaved that intelligently or fought that well. And a lot of them, I think, are simply lack courage. I think it was Richard Brookhiser who said the trouble with Republicans is in their hearts they know they're wrong, you know, which is not a prescription for high morale and fighting spirit. But a lot of them act as if they're defensive all the time.
Well, they are worried about the danger. They constantly worry about the danger of electoral punition, as the political scientists call it.
Yeah, well, of course, the funny thing, they're easily demonized, and the left has taken charge of the vocabulary in these disputes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we get to abortion, it's pro-choice. Who's against choice? When you get to homosexual sodomy, homosexual marriage, which is next on the agenda, it's equality and so forth. They have the advantage of the vocabulary, and the Republicans haven't learned how to develop their own vocabulary to counterattack. And I think they are vulnerable. Republicans are vulnerable to polls because they don't look sympathetic. Now the Democrats have the advantage there, but they don't have. They can't. If they really announced their program, they couldn't get it through in the legislature. That's where they come back to the courts, and that's why they fight so furiously to prevent George Bush from putting these people on the courts of appeals.
Are there enough people on the courts, or potentially appointable to the courts, who might share your views and who might begin to inhibit or control, once again, the grandiose aspirations of the courts to really reshape society?
Yeah, I think there are, but the problem is identifying them and then getting them through.
Well, look to the American Supreme Court right now. We know there will be some retirements fairly soon, probably. What's the prospect there?
Not good, I don't think, because I think the Democrats are going to fight like fury against anybody.
They will bork other nominees.
Yes, and I think they will. They see somebody who, well, if you say you're going to stick to the actual principles of the Constitution, mm-hmm. and not make them up, they will say you're out of the mainstream. And they attack you on that ground. And they will attack you by saying that you favor, for example, if you say the Constitution does not protect abortion. It, you know, either way, it doesn't forbid it, doesn't protect it. It's got nothing to do with it. If you say that, automatically you're in favor of women having back-alley abortions. And, you know, right away you're trying to dig yourself out and explain that that's not what you mean. So they have a considerable rhetorical advantage because people identify not the process by which a judge legitimately reasons to a result, but do they like the result?
We come almost to the end of the available time. Do you think there's anything to the sort of the overall cyclic view of history? And if so, is it possible that this too shall pass?
Well, we know for sure that it will pass, but what it will be replaced by, we don't know, and that's not necessarily an optimistic point of view. People talk about the pendulum swinging. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe it does, but maybe the low point of the pendulum keeps moving to the left as it keeps swinging. So, you know, it comes back away, but never all the way back, and then moves on.
Then why don't you just go fishing? Why do you still care, and why do you still write about these matters?
I'd rather write than fish.
That's a good enough reason. I thank you so much for joining us, and I do want to commend to all who are listening the very important and utterly readable new book by Robert H. Bork, Coercing Virtue, The Worldwide Rule of Judges, is just published by the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you so much for joining us.
I enjoyed it very much.